You're listening to On the Money around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Veronica Alashina. We recently reached the milestone of 25 million people, about 20 years earlier than predicted by the Australian Bureau of Statistics. It is now estimated that we will have almost 17 million extra people to house and feed in the next 40 years. So how will we do it? Roderick Chambers asked Mike Day, principal of Roberts Day Design and Planning Group, what he thought had happened with our growth figures.
I think over time, we seem to have always been pretty wide of the mark when we estimate future population. And it's really been sort of sheeted home, I think, in the last few years that we've got to 25 million, we got to the 25 million sort of 20 years in advance of what was projected by ABS. And then the other thing that's happened is over the last 12 months, we've got about 400,000 people who we've had to accommodate. And we're being told that we need the 16.8 million people that we need to house in the next, you know, in the next 40 years. So that's basically 400,000 each year, which is equivalent to the size of a Canberra every year for the next 40 years. Or alternatively, if you think about it in terms of like a Darwin every 12 weeks. And what we're doing at the moment is we're just sort of incrementally building around the edges in these growth areas, around the two mega cities of Melbourne and Sydney, and obviously to a less extent on the other capital cities. But the two mega cities of Melbourne and Sydney at about 5 million projected to go to 9 or 10 million, and really there's not a lot in between. So some of us are of the view that, you know, it might be prudent to, we've talked over time about having a high-speed rail link between Sydney and Melbourne, and the prospect of maybe building some new cities along this possible rail route would take quite a bit of pressure off.
Well, we'd need cities, wouldn't we? Because whenever they do a study on a high-speed rail link between Melbourne and Sydney, the problem always is that there's not enough in between. There's not enough cities in between like there is in Europe or Japan or America, and it doesn't make it viable. So we actually need to build cities on this route, don't we?
We do, and the advantage of building these cities is that there's been a lot of talk over the last few years about value capture, value creation as well. You know, if you put this infrastructure in, you capture the value around the stations. Now, if you look to Asia and to Europe, they've done it very effectively, and so there's good precedent internationally for us to be able to do that. And then what that does, that helps defray the cost of that infrastructure because, you know, it is quite significant impost to put high-speed rail connection in and then to build these stations. But if you can offset that with land at rural values rather than at the high price of a lot of the metropolitan land in the capital cities, we think that, you know, there's a prospect of, you know, building these new cities in a more affordable manner than we've obviously been able to do in Sydney and Melbourne. And the great thing that appeals to us from an urbanism point of view, because we've been promoting this notion of emulating the great cherished inner neighbourhoods of Melbourne and Sydney. You know, they're the ones that are close in. They're transit-based, so they've got, Melbourne's got the most extensive tram network in the world, but we've got trams, we've got buses, we've got trains. Our forebears laid out an urban fabric that's quite compact, connected, mixed use, you know, it's the terraces, townhouses, and we've mixed the uses up in the past, whereas the planning profession in the last few decades, we've almost had an aversion to allowing uses to coexist, whereas most uses now, there's very few noxious industries or noxious businesses. And we're finding that, you know, a lot of the boomers and the younger generation are looking for that, you know, that almost that urban grit that you get in those compact sort of inner city areas. And we think we can emulate that in a contemporary sense, but start from scratch and build these places that are to enable people to be connected. So walking and cycling, we think, should be the privileged or the privileged mode or the preferred mode, and sort of, you know, reverse that emphasis on the car.
Yeah, well, the other thing is, though, that you've got to be a bit careful about cycling because, yeah, you have to be reasonably fit, have good balance. It's not good for older people, cycling. And weather has, you know, makes a big difference. People think, oh, it's going to be bloody hot today. I'm not going out on the bicycle. Or there's going to be rain, or it's going to be too cold, or, you know. So it's not the total answer, is it? You've got to have some other option.
You do, Rob. But look, just on the cycling issue, because, you know, one of the things that we're noticing too is that because there's so much interest now in walking and cycling, and one of the new dimensions that are coming to cycling is these electric bikes. And I noticed the Mayor of Melbourne, the Lord Mayor, Sally Capp, was just on a jump bike this morning in the paper. And, you know, so Uber have come to Melbourne and bought these electric bikes. Now, I was on them in San Francisco last year, riding the street. You know what the streets of San Francisco are like, right?
Yeah, now, they're fairly steep, as I recall. Yeah.
But they're effortless on these electric bikes. And the distances you can go are quite remarkable. So I've heard stories of people, you know, actually strengthening their muscles up on these electric bikes and then going back on standard bikes. But the key message that we're learning from Europe is you need separate, dedicated paths for cycling and for walking. Because we're now starting to get not only conflicts with the cyclists and the vehicles, but cyclists and the pedestrians.
Oh, yes. I often nearly get run down by a food carrier where we are around here. There is also some sort of a ratio, isn't there, between wheel transport. And I would imagine that with cycling, there'd be kind of a sweet spot, I don't know, maybe between 1 and 5 kilometres. Just off the top of my head, but because there is with tramways and railways, the shorter distances for trams is kind of the more efficient method when you're looking at times going away from a particular node. So maybe that's the way we should be looking at it. A certain distance you'd look at walking and cycling, another distance with on street transport, and then another distance with rail or something.
That's exactly it. Now, we've convinced, you know, traditionally we've used the benchmarks of, you know, from a walkability point of view, we talk about the 5-minute walk, which is 400 metres. It's universally accepted that most people walk to a railway station 10 minutes, which is 800 metres. And then on a bike, in a conventional bike, you usually do sort of 1.2 kilometres, 1.5. But with these electric bikes, I think distances are 5 or 10 kilometres, as long as they're good trails and there's no safety hazards. But I think this is a important sort of dimension in terms of sustainable transport, that we could shift the whole emphasis from cars. Now, you did touch on this issue of climate, and I do think that's important, but look, Copenhagen, there's images of people cycling and, you know, to work and to school in Copenhagen in snow, you know, so they don't seem to be deterred. But I do accept, you know, when in the semi-tropical sort of settings that we've got, say, up in Brisbane and Queensland, that this is where the electric bikes, if you're using the electric a motor, would take, you know, the effort out of, you know, sweating on the bike and that sort of thing.
Mike Day there from Robert Stay, an award-winning design planning and placemaking practice, speaking there with Roderick Chambers.